Welcome to PCMC. I'm Mike Mondrono. I'm here today just by myself. Today, our topic is the 2017 film that no one saw called Brigsby Bear. This is a film that you did not see because it's not a Marvel movie, but it's very, very good. And I want to talk about it because a few months ago, me and Nadia Kader talked about the Netflix show Smash, Saturday Morning All-Star Hits. And that was a show by Kyle Mooney. And this movie is one of his projects as well. And I think it would be really interesting to look at this movie and that show together and sort of get an idea of what they are both saying about 80s and pop culture and fandom and things like that. So, a few show notes before we get started with today's topic. Coming up next month in October, we have Halloween 2022. And if you know PCMC, Halloween is always such a big deal for us. And all month long, we do Halloween episodes. In the past, we've done typically a bunch of different spooky kind of topics or horror kind of topics. Last year, we did an episode on the best jump scares in horror movies. And in the past, we've done things like talk about The Haunted Mansion or Treehouse of Horror, It Follows, things like that. And those are all great episodes to re-listen to if you want to get into the Halloween spooky spirit. But this year, we've got more of a cohesive theme going on. This year, all of our episodes are about witches. So I have a conversation with Nadia Kader about the Japanese horror film House, the horror comedy House, which is about a witch. Me and JGL talk about the Hocus Pocus movies, both of them, the new one and the original. Me and Anthony and Janine will be talking about 90s witches, and you'll see more what that's about. And I had a conversation with Janine about Roald Dahl's The Witches, both the film adaptations and the book. So that's sort of our meditation this year, witches. As always, PCMC is available anywhere podcasts are found. That means Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Spotify, a bunch of little tiny ones that I've never even heard of, but I guess people listen to it through. You could also find us online. We have a YouTube channel now where we upload the podcast. It's just another way of getting the podcast. It's just, you know, just look for Pop Culture Man Children. We're on Instagram, TikTok, and Twitter as @PCMCPod. And we're on Facebook. We have a Facebook group page or Facebook page. And yeah, that's everything. We're all over. So let's talk about Brigsby Bear. So Brigsby Bear comes out in 2017, which is also the year The Last Jedi came out. And that's significant because Mark Hamill is in both Brigsby Bear and The Last Jedi. And it really is a banner year for him because he does, I think, an incredible performance in both movies. Like, real, like, top tier. That was he was on fire that year, which I can't believe is so long ago now, 2017. The Force Awakens came out 2015. So we're only 3 years away from the 10-year anniversary of The Force Awakens. Doesn't that... That makes me sick to my stomach. Okay, so Brigsby Bear was directed by Dave McCary. He worked on Smash with Kyle Mooney. He also directed a lot of the Epic Rap Battles. Do you remember the Epic Rap Battles? The movie is written by Kyle Mooney. It's based on his story that supposedly he came up with when he was a kid. And Kevin Costello. It's produced by Lonely Island... so you know that collective, Lord and Miller, the directors of the Lego movie and other things. And although Lorne Michaels doesn't have a credit, there's a weird credit in the beginning that says something like produced by Lonely Island and LM, which I'm just guessing means Lorne Michaels. Some people online have been calling this an SNL movie, which is itself a very weird category that we could examine in its own episode at some point. Like, what exactly makes a SNL movie? Does it have to be something like Wayne's World, you know, or Night at the Roxbury, where it's based on a sketch? Or does it have to be a movie with a lot of SNL people in it? Does that mean Ghostbusters is an SNL movie? Does a movie have to be produced by Lorne Michaels? I don't know. But I don't know if this necessarily fits into that category. This really fits along with what Kyle Mooney's whole thing is. So Kyle Mooney is a comedian. He's on SNL. He's spoken in interviews about his sort of love of 80s pop culture and all of that sort of like what we now would kind of call VHS culture. The sort of VHS aesthetic and that sort of weird kind of style. I have a pair of sneakers that I kind of don't wear because I like them too much that are modeled after old VHS tapes, but not like mainstream tapes, like the kind of like the blank tapes you would buy to tape TV shows and stuff or bootleg movies. And it's so weird because I would have, you know, at the time during the 90s and 80s, I would have never thought that that would be like an aesthetic we would hearken back to. But the hearkening back is a big part of this movie, and it's a big part of Smash, and it's a big part of popular culture in general. But what I like about Kyle Mooney's work is that it doesn't just put on the 80s as a pastiche. It doesn't just wear the 80s like a coat, like the way the Goldbergs does or Stranger Things to an extent does. It actually seems to be thinking about the 80s for good and bad. And I think that's what makes this movie, Brigsby Bear, so fascinating, because it is in some ways very positive about that kind of fandom, you know, being a fan of a show that's basically for kids and is silly and dumb, but you as an adult put a lot of energy into it. But it also looks at that critically in a way that I think not enough people do. I mean, it's the analogy is that the way that we are now currently obsessed with the 1980s is very similar to the way in the 1970s and 1980s we were obsessed with the 50s, you know, happy days kind of 50s. So in that realm, what you're completely not thinking about is like, you know, the rights of people of color, the rights of LGBTQ people, all of the horrible, horrible things of the 50s, right? You're completely forgetting that. You're just thinking about, like, the Fonzie, you know, diner, malt and milkshake, let's go to the sop hop 50s. That's sort of what you get with most things that think about the 80s. You're not really thinking about, you know, the AIDS crisis or, you know, rampant conservatism and Margaret Thatcher and Ronald Reagan and deregulation and all that. Serious, awful shit. You're thinking about like Totally Tubular and, you know, Color Pink and, you know, that sort of aesthetic that to me mostly makes me think of the opening of Saved by the Bell, like just squiggly lines and just, you know, very quote unquote computer looking, you know, futurism aesthetic. And in a lot of these things that are very, you know, 80 saturated, they are, that's all that they are, that's all that they're doing. Like the Goldbergs especially, like I don't have the time or patience to do this, but I watched the Goldbergs for like the first 7 or 8 seasons. They're about to start season 10, which it was a great show for about 5 seasons, and now it just, I can't believe that it's still going. And now they're about to go on without Jeff Garland because he was fired, and they're going to kill off the character, which is like, just please just end. But anyway, I would love to do a blog where I just reference instances in the Goldbergs where they forget it's the 80s. There are some instances in the show where they make references or they speak in a manner that it's very clear, like, oh, they forgot they were in the 80s at this moment. But that's fine because it's not really the 80s. Like, there's no time period, right? If they want to do an episode on Star Wars, it's about Star Wars. If they want to do an episode on, you know, He-Man, it's, you know, it has nothing to do with, like, the actual continuity of things. So, I guess let's start this conversation by talking about the plot. So, in this movie, the protagonist is played by Kyle Mooney, and his name is James. We're told in the movie that he's 25, which I think is a little too young for how Kyle Mooney looks. They should have made him like 30 or something. But we meet James, and the film begins actually very similar to the way Smash begins, which is you hear a VHS tape being put into a VCR, and you see the play button, or you see the play prompt on the image, and you see those, what we just call tracking lines on the bottom of the image, which VHS was, physically speaking, or technically speaking, not a very good medium. It's a completely transformative medium, an important medium, because it democratized top to bottom media, so now anybody can rent movies and watch movies and it saw a huge rise in cinema and media literacy. But in terms of its actual technical appeal, it's a very bad medium. The very playing of a VHS tape degraded it. You know, you can watch something too many times and therefore, you know, run the tape through the tape heads in the VCR too many times that just by virtue of watching it, you've broken it. And tapes would get broken. Tapes are degrading. You know, VHS tapes from the 80s and 90s today, some of them are just completely just turning to dust. So we begin with the Brigsby Bear TV show, which is a TV show that looks kind of like it looks a little like Barney because there's a big bear costume guy, but it also has a sort of a sci-fi kind of aesthetic. And we see Kyle Mooney, James, sitting in front of his TV watching this Brigsby Bear tape. And we get a look at his room, and his room has Brigsby Bear posters and Brigsby Bear toys. He has a Brigsby Bear bed set, which brought me back to like all the bed sets I had as a kid. I had He-Man and Ghostbusters and all of those things. And he's wearing t-shirts and all sorts of stuff. And he goes online, so he thinks, to talk to put up a review of the last Brigsby Bear. We then meet his parents, Ted and April, and his parents are played by Mark Hamill and Jane Addams, and you see that they have a weird life. They seem to have a particular religion or ideology all to themselves. They say grace at dinner, and then they stand up and shake each other's hands. We learn that the mother is a sort of mathematician, and she homeschools him math all day. The father, Mark Hamill, seems to be a little bit more, you know, less uptight. We see outside of James' room that they are in a kind of an underground facility, like an underground bunker thing, though it has multiple rooms. And at night, Mark Hamill says, okay, good night, I'm going to turn off the generator now and everything powers down. We see that they have something that they call the pier, which is they climb up the ladder and go onto the surface of the earth, and it's sort of like it's kind of like a dome. It's not big. It's just like a small little like room that's made of glass, and just outside of the glass are things like electronic bees and robotic like animals. It's a, you know, you don't sort of know what's going on in the beginning, and it's sort of very sort of trippy, but also kind of like warm in a real way. And Mark Hamill as the dad seems actually pretty warm towards James. One night, we see that Mark Hamill, when he goes outside, he wears a gas mask on his face. One night, in the middle of the night, James, I guess, is bored and feeling rebellious, so he goes outside, and he goes outside of the even of the pier thing, and he's just sort of like, he doesn't go far, he's just standing, he's just sort of sitting by himself outside, and he sees a bunch of cop cars coming with the lights going and the sirens blaring. He runs inside to tell his parents somebody's coming, and he's grabbed, and his parents are arrested. They say, we love you, you know, be brave. They bring, the cops bring Kyle Mooney outside, they put a blanket on him, and he, and this is, I think, very sad the way it's played. He's covering his mouth with the blanket so he, because he thinks he's going to breathe in toxins that will hurt him. They put him in the cop car. They're being very nice to him. He has no idea what's going on. He says, can I get a gas mask? I don't want to get sick. Cop who's driving him is like, you know, I can't really talk to you about this. The detective will talk to you, but just know that you're safe now and it's okay to breathe. They, you know, they open the car window, the back of the car where he is, and at first he's like scared, but then he starts breathing and he seems sort of interested and happy to, you know, be breathing the fresh air. He's brought into an interrogation room, which I'm not sure if in real life they would do, but he meets Greg Kinnear. And Greg Kinnear, he's not being interrogated. That's just the set that they use. Greg Kinnear plays Detective Vogel. And Greg Kinnear, you know, he's not around that much anymore, but he's so good, right? I mean, has he ever been bad? So Greg Kinnear is really, really nice and empathetic as this detective. And we sort of begin to get the story. Greg Kinnear tells James that when he was a kid, Ted and April, who he thinks of as parents, kidnapped him and have been holding him captive underground for the last 25 years. Something I think that is symbolically significant is Greg Kinnear brings him a Coca-Cola in like a glass bottle, which makes me think maybe it's a Mexican Coke, because Mexican Coke still comes in a glass bottle, and people tend to like Mexican Coke because it uses cane sugar rather than, I guess, the processed sugar that's used in American Coke. So, like, you know, whenever I get a chance to drink Mexican Coke, it's always a treat because it just tastes so much like candy. But, like, it makes me think of the philosopher Slavoj Žižek and him talking about how, like, Coca-Cola is the perfect symbol of capitalism because it's a drink that doesn't abate your thirst. It makes you more thirsty. All it does is something you consume that leads to more consumption. It's something that you drink, but it's not good for you. You know, all of the sort of capitalism ideology of Coca-Cola. So he gives him a Coca-Cola. This is this like entrance into the world. You know, here, welcome to the real world. Have yourself a Coca-Cola, which of course he drinks and he likes. There's a very uncomfortable, I guess it's supposed to be a comedy moment, but, you know, I could see a lot of people being offended by it, and it all plays as very odd, but I know why they did it. There's a moment where Greg Kinnear says, "Hey, did they touch you?" And he plays it pretty serious, and then Kyle Mooney's like, "Yes." And he's like, okay. And then Kyle Mooney shakes Greg Kinnear's hand, and he's like, "They would touch me like this." And they'd say, "Good job on your studies, James." And it's supposed to be a joke, but I think it's trying to tell the audience very early on that he was not abused in that way. I mean, he is abused in that he was held captive, that they lied to him, that they kidnapped him, that they told him the world was dangerous and you can't breathe the air. You know, but I guess they wanted to get that out of the way. But it's sort of uncomfortable. And this begins to sort of one thread in the film that I'm okay with, but I could see a lot of people not being okay with. And even in the reviews, which are very positive, people sort of grapple with this. But we'll talk more about that later. So he's introduced to his real parents, who are played by Matt Walsh and Michaela Watkins. You know Matt Walsh from, I think, Veep, and he co-created Upright Citizens Brigade. He's, you know, you've seen him a lot in comedy, and you've also seen Michaela Watkins a lot in comedy. And this movie, I should say, it's categorized as a comedy, and I suppose it is a comedy. It's got mostly comedians in it. It has a lot of jokes. It has comedic moments, but it doesn't strive to be funny all of the time. It has a certain sadness to it. I wouldn't call it a dark comedy or a black comedy, because that usually replies to some sort of violence or some sort of like grimness. It's more of like a sad comedy or a melancholy comedy. So James goes to therapy. His therapist is played by Claire Danes. She's Emily. And now we learn the second big piece of what's going on here, which is James is sort of like, you know, everyone keeps saying that they want to help me, but I just want the newest episode of Bigsby Bear. He believes that every home in the world once a week gets a VHS tape sent to them where they get the newest Bigsby Bear. So, you know, when he goes home with his real parents the first night, he's like, you know, "I just want to watch a new Bigsby Bear." And they're like, we don't have it. And he's like, what are you talking about? He's like, "This, you get one every, you, it comes in the mail every week. Of course you have one." So we find out that his father, or his, you know, captor, played by Mark Hamill, he was producing Bigsby Bear all by himself, and with this actress that he hired, and she thought she was on some Canadian show that she couldn't watch. They actually said that they caught Mark Hamill because people saw him going in and out of this warehouse where he was filming. And he'd been filming for all of James's life. And James doesn't have any other culture in his life. He doesn't know any other books, any other movies, any other music. All he consumes is Bigsby Bear. That's all he knows. Like, when he comes home to his real parents, they're like, "You know, we don't have a VHS player to watch Bigsby Bear, but we can watch things on TV." And he's like, "There are other shows?" He doesn't know what shows are or movies are. He just thinks that all culture is Bigsby Bear. Which is interesting, because it says something, I think, critical about the way, you know, people... let me say millennials, although that's a sort of term that's, I don't know, not great. But let's say millennials, like guys my age or people my age, who feel like the only thing that exists are the culture from our youth. And you should be, you know, that has to be taken very, very seriously. the idea that there's nothing else, it feels to me like Kyle Mooney's saying something critical. So yeah, the father, the captor, Mark Hamill, produced a show. He wrote the show. He's the voice of Briggsby Bear. He plays the bad guy who's like this sun monster called Sun Snatcher, which is just Mark Hamill's face like in a big sun. It reminds me a little bit of like the baby from Teletubbies, or maybe like the moon face man in the 1903 movie Trip to the Moon. You actually see a news report that gives us a kind of info dump, and you learn that the female captor, April, she was a former professor and a mathematician, which explains why she taught him math. But the father, Mark Hamill's character, he was a toy maker, and he made the 80s crazy toy, which is, I forget what it's called, but it's basically supposed to be Teddy Ruxpin. Teddy Ruxpin was a toy from the 80s where it was this animatronic teddy bear, and you put a cassette tape, an audio cassette tape, in its back, and it would play the tape while its lips would move, so it would read you the story. And this was a big hit in the 80s. So it's not called Teddy Ruxpin, but it's basically the male captor is supposed to be someone like the creator of Teddy Ruxpin, which explains kind of like how he makes the Briggsby Bear animatronic for the show, and also like why outside of their little dome there's like the fake bugs and the fake animals. He like constructed this fake world. It's a little bit like the movie Dogtooth, although that's a much more serious dark movie. So James becomes excited when he learns that like anybody can make a movie, and he decides that he wants to make a Briggsby Bear movie because the story isn't over, and now that his captors are arrested, the story is sort of left. And he's the only person in the world who's ever seen Briggsby Bear, but it's his whole culture, it's his whole life, and it's the thing he sort of clings to for comfort. It's sort of like a crutch for him. But interestingly, the movie's honest about it being an obsession and a crutch, but it's also sort of celebrates that kind of love as a positive thing. It's complicated in a way, I think. So he, you know, he's acclimating to life in the real world. He has a younger sister, Aubrey, who's like a teenager. She brings him to a party. He does Molly. He makes friends. Her friend Meredith, who is played by Alexa Demi from Euphoria, she like kisses him and touches his penis, and he like freaks out, but he's thankful for it. You know, it's just, there's a lot of like him getting used to the world thing, you know, not understanding anything. He meets the person who becomes like his best friend, Spencer. Spencer's a friend of his sister, and he's played by George Lindenberg Jr. And he's cool kid. We get the sense that he's cool and people like him. He's the one throwing the party. But he is a nerd in the sort of contemporary sense of the word nerd, where he's just very media literate. He makes special effects things on his home computer. He's wearing a Star Trek shirt when we meet him, although James is like, is that from Briggsby Bear? Like, he doesn't know what Star Trek is. He doesn't know what anything outside of Briggsby Bear is. So they become friends. His sister has a hard time sort of dealing with him. She's not outright like mean to him in a sort of after school special way where you'd be like, why would she do that? But you could tell she's having a hard time dealing with him and his sort of odd, how eccentric he is. There's a little bit of Edward Scissorhands thing going on towards the middle of this movie where people recognize him because it's a big news story. This guy was kidnapped as a kid and kept in this weird underground world, and now he's out. So like, you know, he meets people in the supermarket who are like excited to see him, but they're super insensitive to him and his real mom about the situation. Like, oh, you're the kidnap kid. Can I get a picture with you? And, you know, people are interested in him. Everyone kind of knows who he is. His friend Spencer, they talk about Briggsby Bear, and Spencer's like, I want to see Briggsby Bear. So he gives him some VHS tapes, and Spencer actually uploads them to the internet, which leads to this thing where other people in the world start watching Briggsby Bear, and it becomes famous in its own right, although I guess in a slightly ironic way, because you see a montage of a lot of people watching Brigsby Bear, but you see them kind of laughing at it. Because the one of the weird things about Brigsby Bear was every episode, and again, this is a lot like 80s kids programming, every episode would end with like a PSA, but all of these PSAs were made specifically for James. So it'd be like, remember to throw your trash out in the yellow container, not the red container, or remember to always sweep in the corridor outside your room. Or, if you're getting romantic feelings, remember to only touch your penis 2 times a day. So, you know, you could see that there's this weirdness of, like, it's made to indoctrinate one person. But it's also made to, like, educate one person. Like, the thing that James always says about Brigsby Bear is that he it's about love and friendship and overcoming the odds. And it's a very positive, like, thing for him. And I think other people see that. And so Spencer, his newfound friend, is like, we'll make the movie together. And they make the movie together. And in one very interesting and kind of funny, kind of sad scene, he's going through the storyboards with Spencer. And he's telling the story of the movie. And he's like, yeah. And then the cops come and they take Brigsby Bear from the cabin he's lived his whole life. And they take his parents away, and then he's thrown into this castle, this new world that he doesn't know, and clearly he's just projecting into it what's going on with him. And a few times, and again, I could see people being offended by this, but there's at least 3 or 4 times in the story where Kyle Mooney's character will make little references to the fact that he still cares about the people that captured him. Like, sometimes he'll call them, he'll be like, my old dad. Or he'll be like, when he's talking about the story, he's like, yeah, you know, his bear parent, when he's talking about the movie, he's like, yeah, and, you know, he'll be reunited with his bear parents because, you know what they did was bad, but, you know, it wasn't that bad. So you see a certain Stockholm syndrome in him, which is, again, it's complicated. But I think there are positive ways to read this movie. And I think, in general, it's not like an uncomfortable movie. Like, it's not like, it's not like Room, you know? Like, it's not like the kind of thing that'll, like, make your skin crawl or, like, make you sick to your stomach. It's certainly not, you know, all comfortable. But I guess getting somebody like Mark Hamill, who's, like, America's uncle, Luke Skywalker, someone that we all know and like and seems so affable and avuncular to play the male captor, I think is a really smart casting choice because it makes us not immediately think of him as evil or terrible. You kind of see them as sort of sad figures themselves. So Detective Vogel, Greg Kinnear's character, he is very friendly to James, and James comes and talks to him, and he's like, I want to get the Brigsby Bear, all the costumes and props and stuff, because I want to make a Brigsby Bear movie. And he's like, well, I can't really get you that stuff because it's all evidence. And then James is like, you know, gets to know him, and he's like, I understand creativity. When I was young, I would do plays. And James is like, well, you got to be in the Brigsby Bear movie. And, you know, you could see that Greg Kinnear's character is very, very empathetic and wants to help him, and actually, like, steals some props from the department and brings it to James. And James is, like, so thrilled to see all this stuff, and he's so excited about it. But then Matt Walsh, the father, is like, I don't know if this is good for him. And Greg Kinnear is like, yeah, you're right. And sometimes Matt Walsh, does a really good sort of dramatic, although he's funny in it, but he also has real dramatic moments in it. He says, you know, these aren't collectibles. These are tools that sick people used to imprison my son. And Greg Kinnear's like, yeah, you're right, I'm sorry. So the movie doesn't gloss over the weirdness of it. Some of the negative reviews would kind of say that it does, and I would say that it at least, maybe it doesn't totally wrap it up in a bow, but it doesn't wimp out and try to make you forget about it. It keeps making you remember the weirdness of the situation and how complicated it is that Brigsby Bear is so important to James, yet it was used as a tool kind of to indoctrinate him. So I talked before about there's this young actress who is on the Brigsby Bear show, and we see her grow up with James, and so she was on the show for many, many seasons, and she actually plays two characters. She plays Ariel and Nina, who are supposed to be twins, but it's just old-fashioned, like, you know, Parent Trap kind of camera work. And we see early on in the movie when he's still inside the facility, like when they do lights out, like he uses a flashlight and looks at her poster and jerks off, but not in a kind of, I don't know, I want to say a sweet way, although it's hard to talk about jerking off in a sweet way. It just, you get this idea that this is the only female he's ever seen or knows about in the world. And she's grown up with him, so he's sort of like in love with her in a way. And he mentions at some point that he wants to try to find her. So in the second act, of course, things get a little bit worse for our character. They go on a very nice camping trip, James, Spencer, Meredith, and his sister Aubrey. And him and his sister actually start to connect, and it's very sweet, and it's actually, I think, very heartwarming. I think there's actual very sweet, heartwarming stuff in this. It's a movie that can be earnest, and James's character is very earnest. And I mean earnest. I don't mean sentimental. I don't mean saccharine. I don't mean trying to be earnest, which of course will always turn you off. Like, genuinely earnest. There is a scene in the movie they're making where Brigsby runs away from, and James is now playing Brigsby, runs away from an explosion, and Spencer's like, I'll just do it with VFX or CGI, and James, he doesn't tell him, but he creates an actual, like, bomb, basically, this small improvised bomb, and it goes off. They're in a national forest, so it goes off. They, you know, Spencer gets mad. He's like, you can't do that. You can't just explode a bomb in the world. And then the cops come and arrest them. James doesn't get in too much trouble with the police, although he could. He could be charged with domestic terrorism, but they let him go. But we then see the sort of fallout is when he's in therapy, you know, he's crying and he's there with his parents. And the therapist is like, you need to give up on Brigsby. You need to move on from Brigsby. And he's like, Brigsby's my whole life. And Matt Walsh, the father, kind of like is at the end of his rope, and he's like, your whole life, our whole life, we've been looking for you, and our life was ruined by these people who took you from us and stole you from us. And it's sort of heartbreaking. It really is. Like, everything about it's heartbreaking. Like, you feel, you know, you feel heartbreak for the parents, but you also feel bad for James, because it's like, you know, imagine the thing you love the most. You know, for me, it would be like, I don't know, you know, reading or Star Wars or Ghostbusters, or, you know, one of the things that is sort of my comfort food in terms of media, you know. And what if somebody just said, no, it's bad for you. The people who made it were trying to hurt you, and you really should never think about it again or engage with it again. That would be hard for anybody, really. So you kind of feel bad for everybody all around. The parents decide, along with the therapist, that he should be put into a facility, a mental health facility. And again, I think this is played very well. It's not like, you know, it's not One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest. It's not like in Ghostbusters 2 where they lock them up in the booby hatch. It looks like a hospital. It looks, you know, and there's nothing really scary going on. It, you know, it, here is where we meet a very small side character played by Andy Samberg, who's someone he meets inside. Of course, he's one of the producers. And we learn from the therapist that both Ted and April pled guilty, so they're going to be going to jail for a long time. And she tells James it's okay to feel conflicted about that. James decides that he has to run away. And one of the biggest laughs in the movie, Eric, played by Andy Serban, comes to James and he's like, you know, how are you going to run away? And James is like, it's very complicated. And then smash cut to a TV being thrown out a window. And then James just crawls, like, out the window. And he goes home. But when he's home, we're towards the end of the movie now. When he goes home, he sees that his parents and his friends and Detective Volga are all there constructing the Brigsby Bear set in their garage. And he's like, what is this? And they're like, you know, we wanted to do this for you for a surprise. And he's like, well, the therapist told me that I'm not even supposed to think about Brigsby Bear. The father, Matt Walsh, is like, we think maybe she's being a little too hard on you. We love you, and we love you for who you are, and Brigsby Bear is a big part of who you are, and that's okay. And so as a family, they finish the movie. It ends with, you know, a big premiere. It's very sweet. On the marquee, it says, Brigsby Brand movie that I made with my friends. He's nervous about the movie, and what if people don't like him? We see in... I forgot a part. I'm sorry. This is like hearing a bad joke from a five-year-old. Oh, wait. I forgot to say there's a cow in the bar. At one point, he goes and finds the actress who played April and Nina, and they're the same age, and she's a waitress in a diner, and she's very beautiful, and she's very sweet, and he's obviously enamored with her, and she now understands what happened, and she's like, I feel so bad. If I had known what this all was, I wouldn't have done it, and I feel sorry. And he's like, no, like, would you do it again? And she's like, I don't know. Okay, cut back to the end of the movie. We're seeing scenes from the movie that he made, and she's in it. She did come back to play April and finish the story. And this is actually a scene where April kisses Bigsby Bear, and you see everyone in the audience kind of like, ooh, this is weird. But clearly he's working through something. We see that, oh, and Drake Kinnear's character plays like a wizard in the movie. We see that he changed the ending. The ending that he originally described to us with the storyboards was that he's reunited with his bear parents, but James has grown. And in the end, the big bad sun monster, who is, I guess, now played by Kyle Mooney, he comes out, and Brigsby Bear realizes there's nothing he can do to get rid of the sun monster. It's always going to be there. So Greg Kinnear's wizard character is like, the only thing you could do is you could fold every molecule in the galaxy and make this existence go away, and you go into a new existence and start new. So Bigsby Bear says goodbye to April and Nina, and you know that he cares about them, but he's got to start new. And then he goes and starts a new world, and it's this, I don't know, very beautiful evocation of this idea that that's what James is going to do now. He's going to accept that he's in a new world, and by making the Brigsby Bear movie, he's sort of closing the story, but also closing that part of his life. He can't watch the movie because he's nervous. He comes out after the movie, and all his friends and family are clapping for him. They're all so excited for him. And in the background, like behind everybody, only he could see what looks like Brigsby Bear standing there. And Brigsby Bear waves to him, and then touches, like, I guess, some like vortex manipulator on his wrist and disappears. And I don't think it's meant to be like he was crazy and he could see him all along. I think if that were the case, they would have shown that. I think it just symbolizes that, like, the very real part of his life that was Brigsby Bear is now gone, and he's in this new world. And that's really the end of the movie. So let's talk a little bit about the sort of tone of the film. It's directed, I think, like a drama. The director, I think, takes the material and tries to handle it all with a certain verisimilitude that sometimes does slip into melodrama, but it's not directed like a comedy, although I feel like it's written like a comedy. If you took this script and gave it to someone like Judd Apatow, it could be a much more silly movie. But I think it's okay the way it is. I like it the way it is because some elements in this world are very real and grounded, and some are very fantastic. And Kyle Mooney himself in his performance is sometimes very silly and funny, and a lot of the comedy is coming from him and his reaction to the world. But also, it's very sad. I mean, the culture shock that he's going through is really an interesting thing to watch. So a lot of, you know, 80s pop culture comes up in PCMC. I mean, the PCMC logo has She-Ra in it. And as much as that comes up, I do, and I hope you see from the many episodes that we've produced, I do try to talk about lots of other things and stay abreast of what other people like and what young audiences are watching. And, you know, I've never thought of PCMC as just about, like, me talking about Ghostbusters. You know, we talk about a lot of different things. We talk about books. We talk about games. We talk about, you know, dramas. We talk about stuff. But, you know, I do have to admit that there is a lot of stuff about 80s nostalgia, just because I'm a 39-year-old guy who was born in 1983. So a lot of that stuff speaks to me. But I could say, you know, plainly, as someone who's not a dummy, that I know that this stuff isn't all good. Or how do I put it? You know, like I have a master's degree in cinema and media studies, and I taught cinema and media courses for like 9 years and thought about a lot about this stuff. And I can tell you from just an objective point of view that I know, like, you know, a lot of the cartoons I loved, like He-Man and Ninja Turtles, they're not good. Like, if you watch them now, there's charming things about them, I'm sure, but, like, there's nothing good. Like, the way I would now look at a cartoon for kids, like, I don't even know what kids watch now. And I watched, like, the cool, quote-unquote, like, cool stuff, like, you know, like, Infinity Train and stuff like that. But, like, the just the normal, everyday kid stuff that they watch, I'm sure I would look at it and not mock it, but I'd be like, okay, that seems nice. So there's no deep connection. So I know a lot of the things that I'm connected to based on my age and based on the fact that I consumed it before I had an intellectual discerning taste. But I think what's going on in this film here is that kind of overall problem, dealing with that problem. You know, a lot of people in the positive reviews for this film have said, this is such a love letter to fandom. This is about fandom. And it is, but it's more complicated than that. You know, I think one way to read this film is, you know, we live in a hegemonic culture. Now, excuse me if I get a little bit lefty here and a little bit philosophy here, but, you know, apparatus theory is a sort of leftist media culture theory that basically says that the media and, you know, movies, TV, all that stuff is all an apparatus of the machine of capitalism, and it serves a function in capitalism. It serves the function of showing us the ideology of a capitalist culture and normalizing it for us. Examples are like characters like Iron Man or Robin Hood or Batman. You know, it's this idea of don't hate rich people. Rich people will save us. We should love and lord rich people. Rich people aren't the cause of our problem. Things like that. But then even more subtle things like the way the media portrays gender and sex and love and, you know, violence and justified violence and stuff like that. American media, it reflects the American capitalist ideology. And you look, there's no ethical consumption under capitalism, right? Like, if you drink Coca-Cola, you are accepting that you are paying money to a corporation that, you know, in some places in the world, literally threaten and beat people for trying to start unions. You know, I know that if you wear Nike sneakers, you're wearing products that are made in sweatshops. But it's not just Nike. Lots of our stuff is made in sweatshops. And I'm not giving it as an excuse. I'm not saying that you shouldn't be aware of it, or you shouldn't feel a little bad about it. But I guess what I'm saying is being literate, being aware of the way things are constructed, that is what is important. Like, we use the term woke, but it's not woke, because woke is like something that happens once. Like, it's wakening. Like, you have to constantly keep yourself awake. And part of that is by being critical to the things you consume. And what you see in the film, what you see happening with James and Brigsby Bear is similar to this idea. A media scholar named Henry Jenkins, he wrote this interesting book on fandom called Textual Poaching. And what that was about is the idea that media texts and fandom culture is interactive, not just in this sort of contemporary sense where, like, you can remash things and remake things and make podcasts about things. He's talking about how you could actually, like, read something and take from it something you want. You can look at a text that may be problematic and say, what in it do I find useful in my life? What in it means something to me? What values are there that are good? We're actually seeing something like this happening in real time with the very large fandom of Harry Potter, because the author of Harry Potter, J.K. Rowling, has kind of become very, very anti-trans and transphobic. And a lot of what people saw in Harry Potter, a lot of what people loved about Harry Potter, was this idea of, like, love and acceptance and friendship and things like that. So instead of just saying, well, let's boycott her and let's boycott Harry Potter, Harry Potter, like Brigsby Bear to James, is too foundational for people. Harry Potter is so, and you know, especially people younger than me, like someone who really, like, read it as a kid, It is so important to people. And they think like, how can I can't just give up Harry Potter. And it's fine. It doesn't make you a bad person for liking Harry Potter. But what you're doing is textual poaching. You're saying what works in Harry Potter and what doesn't. And let me be aware of what doesn't. You know, people have pointed out like the character Nymphadora Tonks is kind of like a trans character, but presented in a negative way. And okay, so that's in there and you ignore that. You don't ignore it and pretend it's not there, but you say, I won't poach that. I won't take that and say, this is important. This is what's meaningful to me in my life. Like I love Ghostbusters. An episode does not go by where I don't talk about it, but you know, Ghostbusters ideologically, there's a lot of bad stuff in it. The Environmental Protection Agency is the bad guys. Going into business and having no regulation is the good thing. I'm an atheist. People in Ghostbusters, in the world of Ghostbusters, if you don't believe in ghosts, you're a fucking idiot and you're wrong. And that's not even mentioning like Bill Murray's problematic harassment of Sigourney Weaver's character. But I'm not pro-harassment. I'm not anti the EPA. You know, I know that all of that shit is wrong-headed. But there are things about Ghostbusters that I can poach, that I could take and say, this is useful. You know, laughing at things that scare you. That's what is important to me about Ghostbusters. The idea of James making a Briggs & Bear movie, I don't think is him taking his trauma and letting himself be stuck in it. I think it's him taking this text that was everything to him and now taking it over, taking it from his abusive father figure and being the person who controls it now, and not just ending it, but saying this is what was important in it. And I think that that is a really positive message. Because, and here's another thing to think about, you know, how do you get away from things, especially if you live in the first world? Like, okay, how do you say, I don't want to wear clothes that are made in economic labor exploitation? Well, then what, you're going to make your own clothes? You're going to farm your own fruits and vegetables? You don't like the way that, you know, animals are slaughtered? You're going to hunt your own animals, raise your own animals? I mean, you could become a vegetarian like I am, but you can't boycott everything. You just can't. And the same thing goes for ideology. Culture is everything. You can't step outside of culture. You can't say, you know, you can be critical of culture from within it. You can be literate of culture from within it, and be subversive. I mean, there's something subversive about textual poaching, to say, no, this is the thing I like about it, and I don't like this other thing about it. But you can't completely step out of it, because there's no out of it. You know, like when I used to teach media courses, sometimes students would ask me, am I saying that we're brainwashed? And I would always say no, because one, that's too simple. It's more complicated than that. And two, brainwashed would imply that you had a brain to begin with, that you had a brain and this brain believed certain things and knew certain things. And then this nefarious thing came and washed your brain and scrambled your brain and put these new ideas in. It's not brainwashing. It is inculcation. You know, from the moment you are born, you're a sponge that suck up culture. You know, there are things that we know and we believe and are a part of us that we just get from culture that no one ever formally taught us. So that's the thing. Like, was James brainwashed? Well, in a certain sense, yes. But also, every person needs culture. And clearly, the culture is, the Bixby Brayer is more of an influence on him than his mother and father, or his captor mother and father, actually were. In the very beginning, you see that April, the woman who actually stole him, she wants him to focus more on math, and she wants him to focus less on Briggsby Bear. And she's sort of jealous of the father because the father makes the Briggsby Bear. And you sort of see this thing of like, Briggsby Bear is his whole culture. And when he gets out to the world, he starts consuming other culture, and you see that he likes it. He goes to see stupid movies and he likes them, and he starts listening to music and he starts, you know, experiencing the world. But when he's told by the therapist to just completely not think about Briggsby Bear, it's an impossibility for him. And it would be an impossibility for anybody. It would be an impossibility for me to go to the lovely Jennifer Grace Luttrell and say to her, Harry Potter is bad now, and we know that the creator of Harry Potter is bad, and I want you to not think about it anymore. I would never request such a thing, and I would never think such a thing is possible. It's not. And as much as Harry Potter is important to JGL and important to Janine, another part of the show, and important to a lot of people, that's not all they had. Like, Briggsby Bear is literally the only anything that James has. So I understand it being complicated, and I also understand, and you know, God forbid if this happened to you, a real person who was maybe kidnapped or something similar to this happened to them watching this movie and being completely disgusted by that. I totally respect and understand why you would be disgusted by that, or why you would say this is Stockholm Syndrome and this is not something to be thought of as a comedy. What I'm saying is, what's useful about it is looking at James's situation as a metaphor for the way that we all consume media and the positive ways we can read media and recontextualize and reconfigure media to be something important for us. Okay, so that's Briggsby Bear. I've basically explained the whole thing to you, so you don't have to watch it. But actually, go and watch it, because it is really interesting. It's really sweet. The performances are great. I haven't talked about the music, but the music is really great. It is, I think, a really... It's a quick film, too. It's like around an hour and a half. It's not very long. It goes down very easy. You know, it's not scary or, you know, it's I think really a great movie, and it has an 82% positive score from critics on Rotten Tomatoes, and it has an 86% positive from actual just viewers. So it's very well received, and I hope people continue to look at it. And yeah, I would say go and watch it. And I would also say that like what you like, but like it critically. Being a fan of something is about being interactive with it, is about engaging with it. It's not about completely accepting. All right, this has been PCMC. Thank you so much for being here today. Thank you so much for listening. The numbers keep going up. We keep getting greater engagement, more and more people listening, and it just means so much to me and everyone who works on the show, because we do put a lot into this, and we do work hard on the show, and knowing that people are listening and engaging and getting something from the episodes is just like the greatest thing in the world. And we would love to hear from you, so you know, slide into our DMs whenever you want, or contact us in any way you want. Thank you so much for listening, and I can't wait for October. I can't wait for you guys to see what we've got going for October. So as we end every episode, go bye-bye.